Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Colborn.
And hello, everyone. It's a beautiful day here, finally. We had a major rainstorm this morning again, but oh my gosh. But now the sun is shining, and so we're off to the races.
Well, we're a little bit, we're about half an hour east or west of you, and usually the weather moves west to east, and it's clouding up here, so I'm not sure how long your sun's going to last there, Mom.
Okay, well, I can handle it. I got a good roof.
So, well, you know, the weather, of course, is one of the great mysteries of life.
And yes.
We all love a good mystery, don't we?
Yes, we do, and this is a good mystery. Oh, is it a good mystery? This is actually the second mystery of our author, Roger Johns. He is the author of Dark River Rising, his first mystery, and this one, The River of Secrets, is his second mystery, and we're going to be discussing today. We're not going to tell the ending. We don't do that. We don't spoil it for anybody. And you will really want to know what happens, I'm sure. Roger is a former corporate lawyer and college professor with law degrees from Louisiana State University and Boston University. He was born and raised in Louisiana, though he and his wife now live in Georgia. So welcome to the program, Roger.
Thank you, Caroline. I'm happy to be here with you all today.
Now, Roger, I understand that you were an attorney, and
yes,
the books that you're writing are police procedural detective mystery novels.
Correct.
So how much of your background as an attorney comes to play in these novels?
Well, before I was a corporate lawyer, my last year or two of law school and my first year after law school, I worked for a general practice firm, and we did a fair amount of criminal law. So it was really that part of my legal profession that enters into the books. It helps me understand the procedures that the police use and how these things shape up. From a legal defense perspective. So really my corporate law part of me just was more about the discipline of sitting down and writing and less about the content of the story. And it was those early days that gave me a platform to jump off of for the legal end of it.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, it all helps, doesn't it? It all helps to pull it together when you know the ins and outs of everything.
Yes, it does. Much of the mood of the story comes from years of work that I did between college and law school, though, when I was still living in Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of work were you doing?
I worked for a very interesting company. For a while, I worked for the state legislature when I was right out of college, but I quickly moved to another company or to a private company. It worked in North Baton Rouge. North Baton Rouge is different from South Baton Rouge. It's very industrial. It's considerably more chaotic than South Baton Rouge. And it's a very working class area of the city, whereas the southern part of the city is somewhat more genteel and very wealthy and a very stable community. And the company I worked for went into factories that stretched up north along the river and took these high-pressure cleaning equipment into the factories to clean their reaction vessels. It's very, very dangerous work. The people I worked around were very dangerous, but very interesting people. And the things I saw and the things I learned left a huge impression on me. As a young kid who had come out of a suburban neighborhood in a quiet central Louisiana town, and I was suddenly living amongst a very different kind of people and place than I'd grown up in, working there during the day and then going home to a rather peaceful area of town at night. It was a very disconcerting experience, and it obviously left a big mark on me because now I'm writing books that sort of tap into that mood and that place and that time.
And I believe you're in the process of writing another book, too, aren't you?
I'm actually, yes, I am, Caroline. I'm actually in the process of writing two books, a third in the Law Department Theory, and a standalone about a dirty cop. This one, I'm not sure exactly where it's going to be set. It might be in Louisiana somewhere, but it need not be. It could be anywhere.
Oh, golly. Sounds interesting.
So how do you get the information or the knowledge to write about the police? Do you have people that you talk to make sure you're getting it right the way a police force would work?
Well, my books are considered by my publisher and booksellers to be police procedurals, but the procedure part of it is a very small dimension of the story. These books are about the main character, Wallace Hartman, who is the homicide detective who is at the wheel in both of these stories. And I've managed to keep the technical aspect of it to a minimum. And that was intentional on my part. I'm much more interested in the people and how these stories affect them than I am, say, the details of a plot or the details of some legal or police procedure, or even the science. And there was a teeny bit of science in the first book, and I worked very hard to keep that to a minimum. I'm just one of these people that enjoys knowing more about people, and this has been a great way for me to explore some people and personalities that I haven't known directly myself.
But still, there is some aspect of, you know, how a detective goes about finding evidence and dealing with the evidence that they find. So you have to know something about it.
Sure, and I do. I spent a fair amount of time as a young lawyer and a law student when I was at the general practice firm, dealing with police, dealing with criminal defendants, dealing with the legal and procedural issues that came up, and all of that stuck with me pretty well. It's also the case that one of the men I practiced law with all those years ago is still practicing criminal law in Baton Rouge. And from time to time, I've called him to ask him about things that appear to have changed in the law or areas that I didn't really get a chance to deal with way back then. But for the most part, it's stuff that I've come across or done research on myself. Interestingly, I have two good friends who are also writers and published writers that write police procedurals, and they're retired homicide detectives. One lives in Portland, Maine, and one is from California. And they both read the book, and they said, yeah, this is great. This is the way it happens. Good for you. I don't know who you talk to, but if you ever need some help from us, we're available. So I guess I just got lucky on that.
That's great. Well, it's good to know that you are sort of checking it. You're having somebody who's been there vetting it to make sure that the details do make sense, because that's an important part of making a story believable. I get your point about wanting it to be more about the people and the stories, but if the details behind it aren't real, then it's hard to believe the story.
Without question, you're exactly right about that. And I am a real stickler for detail and a real stickler for research. Thank goodness for Google Street View, because if there's anything about Baton Rouge that I get wrong, I know I'm going to get a call from somebody there. So I will look at things up close in Google Street View to make sure I have all the geographic detail or all the historical details very, very well under control. Because I don't want to get that email. I don't want to get that letter from a reader.
The downside of that is you don't have an excuse to take a tax-deductible trip to Baton Rouge, then.
Well, I guess I could. maybe I'll do something about that. I'm going to the Louisiana Book Festival later this year.
Maybe
I'll be doing some research on some things that I just can't get from the internet.
Now, Baton Rouge is where you grew up, correct?
I grew up in Alexandria, Louisiana, which is right in the middle of the state. It's an L-shaped state, and Alexandria is in the middle of the upright of the L. Town of about 40,000 people. Very interesting place. Baton Rouge was college and law school in early working years for me.
Okay. And what made you decide to set your books there rather than somewhere that you've lived later in your life?
Well, I don't have a really good answer for that. Everything about the first book changed, including the gender of the main character, before this book before the first draft of it was ever finished. And I deliberated over virtually every aspect of the book. The one thing that I never gave any conscious thought to or had any internal debate about was the setting. It seemed to set itself there naturally. It's a dangerous story about a dangerous place, and Baton Rouge has elements to it that seemed, I guess, at some instinctive level, very accommodating to stories of the kind I wanted to tell. And I love Baton Rouge, but it has baffled me because of the experiences I had there. So I'm guessing this is just one of my ways of dealing with all the things that I learned and experienced all those years ago.
Well, the interactions between Wallace and, for instance, her the person who helps her investigate, they didn't get along so well right at first, but the interactions between her and the other characters make the story move along smoothly, because you can get stuck in the bits and pieces of investigation if you didn't have this interaction between the characters, which I thought was interesting.
Thank you for saying that. I enjoyed that part of the story immensely. I had no idea how that was going to turn out. I knew the answer to the mystery from the beginning. That's just sort of the way I roll on this. But I didn't really know how the interaction between Wallace and Mason was going to turn out. There were some very nice surprises in there. And in the beginning, when I first tried to write the story, Mason was the main character, and Wallace was nowhere around. But he turned out not to be the guy to carry this thing forward, and she turned out to be sort of a miraculous thing that just showed up in my head.
That's interesting.
So how far did you get into writing that first book before you realized that Wallace was who you were really wanting to write about?
I think maybe 70 pages, give or take a few, and I wrote those 70 pages over and over dozens of times. The only thing that never really changed was the first paragraph of the book. Everything else, I kept trying and trying and trying. And he's a great character. He's an interesting guy, and there's a lot of value to him in the way the book is written, but for some reason, he was not the one. This was her story, and this little voice just showed up in my head one day. You need a woman at the wheel in this story. You're going the wrong way with this. So yeah. I listened. I took it to heart, and wouldn't you know it, within just a few months, I had completed the book. It was far too long, but I had gotten it over the finish line.
Do you think it's unusual for men to write like a female detective? Is that fairly unusual?
Well, it's certainly not commonplace. While I was writing this story, I was also reading a couple of books called The Ava Lee Mysteries, written by a Canadian author, and I found it interesting. And when it came time to write this one from the perspective of a female character, I realized, yes, it could be done. I didn't know how I was going to do it. In fact, when I finished it, I asked my wife to read it, and she said, "This is great, but it's still a guy. You've just changed a lot of the pronouns. I know you think you did this, right? But you need help, and it's not going to be me." For all the usual reasons, right? You never teach your spouse how to play golf or drive a car. So that's just begging for trouble. So I joined the Women's Writers Group, and they taught me how to do it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Very good.
So what was it like for you?
And I'm a school student. It took at least a year for them to get through my hard head what I needed to do and how I needed to do it.
Well, that's the question then. Did did learning to write from a female perspective change your perspective on women in real life?
Oh, without question, it has changed me as a man, so much for the better. I'm in my early 60s now. When I began writing this book in earnest with Wallace as the main character, I was in my late 50s. And I was just totally dismayed by the fact that most of the things I thought I knew, I just didn't. And it gave me a whole new appreciation for the patience of my wife, because it couldn't have been a happy day every day with such a dunce in the house with her. But I feel like I'm getting better. I really do. And I've learned to see things in a different way. I've learned to consider situations in a different way. It's been an amazing experience, and I would recommend it to everybody. If you want to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes, try writing from their perspective. And it's not the real thing, but it's pretty darn close.
Well, congratulations.
Well, that's interesting.
Thank you.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Roger Johns, author of River of Secrets, a Wallace Hartman mystery. Now, where did the name come from?
I don't know, and I realize I'm answering a lot of your questions with I don't know, but so much of this just sort of showed up. It was originally the name that was attached to the character that I now call Mason. But I liked it so much, I decided to keep it as the name of the main character. And it's the case that, at least in the South, at least in the part of the South where I grew up, that parents often name their children, give their children a first name that was the last name of another branch of the family. And that's how I envisioned it. So somewhere in Wallace's ancestry, there's a branch of her family with the last name Wallace.
Oh, okay.
And it just seemed like a good name.
I wondered about that. Yeah, I wondered about that, how you came up with that name.
I have gotten emails from people saying that when they began reading the book, and her name is the first word you read in the first book, that they just assumed it was a guy, and that when the first feminine pronoun showed up later in that first sentence, they just assumed that there were still typos in the book. And it wasn't until later that they realized, well, hey, you know, she can have that name too.
So, would you like to read a little bit from River of Secrets, Roger, so that we can get a feel for this style?
Sure, I would love to. I have looked at a couple of different places. I think the best thing would be for me to read the first few pages, where you will get a sense of what this mystery is about and what Wallace is about. And then I could read a little bit later on so you can see, and so the listeners can see exactly how this situation is going to become dangerous for Wallace and Baton Rouge. Would that work out?
That sounds great.
Wonderful. I'll start with the prologue and the first chapter, which are about 3.5 pages, and I'll skip later to another character, and we'll get to see him. So this is the prologue, and it begins on a Friday night in June. When he heard the key slide into the lock, he reached inside his shirt and ran a finger along the smooth edge of the tough plastic loop. Heavy footfalls on the old hardwood floors told him one person, a sizable individual, had entered the kitchen through the side door. Expletives followed by muttered self-rebukes about having forgotten something confirmed the new arrival's identity. Herbert Marino was home. The sound of the case being zippered open, along with the scuff and rustle of items shifted around on a table, pinpointed Herbert's location in the dining area of the large front room. Then the steady rhythmic ticking of computer keys started. People could be so vulnerable when they were under the spell of some routine activity, something that put them at ease and commanded their undivided attention. But he knew that now was not the magic moment. Herbert's booming voice broke the quiet. The call. Ordinarily, this would have been an excellent time to shine. Pedestrians were known to step into fast-moving traffic once they became mesmerized by a call. But this was Herbert's nightly Skype session with his wife. "You look lovely," Herbert told him. "Yes, especially without your makeup." Using the loud conversation as cover, he rose from his hiding place inside the spare bedroom and moved toward the hallway and waited. The intimate patter continued for several minutes. Once the conversation ended, the keystrokes resumed along with the soft sound of easy listening music and the shuffle of papers. After several minutes, or the time felt right, he emerged from the dark room, taking care to avoid the creaky floorboards he had discovered in the hall while he waited for the man of the hour to return from a hard day of screwing the taxpayers. Herbert sat at the dining table, facing away, staring intently at a laptop. As he closed the distance between them, the man slid his hand inside the front of his shirt. The floor groaned under his final step. Herbert stiffened and turned. He dropped the loop over Herbert's head and yanked hard on the free end. Chapter 1. Wallace Hartman didn't fancy herself a burglar, but when Davis McCone called with larceny in his heart, she jumped at the chance, even though she was a Baton Rouge police detective and she would be stealing from her own mother. Uncle Davis. She had called him that when she was a young girl, although he wasn't really her uncle, just a good family friend. In fact, Davis was the man her mother had dated before electing to marry Walter Hartman instead. They had all managed to stay friends, and Davis and his eventual wife, Gail, had been uncle and aunt to the Hartman children. "Come have dinner with us tomorrow evening," Davis said. "Us who?" "Me and your mother." "She didn't mention the two of you were having dinner. I only managed to talk her into it a little while ago. It's a birthday shindig. You know she doesn't like calling attention to her birthday. She enjoyed acting like she doesn't like it. So why do you want me there? I'll just be a third wheel." "Not a wheel. A thief. And bring Mason." Mason Cunningham had entered Wallace's life several months ago as a DEA analyst, pursuing an investigation that intertwined with one of her own. He had remained as much more than that. Since Thursday, Mason had been in D.C. He was returning this afternoon. "Okay, we'll be there," Wallace said. "And just so I've got this straight, you actually want me to steal something for you?" "You'll enjoy it, I promise, and your mother will be delighted. I promise that as well." There wasn't much Wallace wouldn't do for Davis. When Wallace's father had been killed, along with her husband and her elder brother, by a man who had made a vocation of drinking and driving, her life had hit a wall. Wallace and her mother Carol and surviving brother Lex had all hit the wall. Carol had gone almost mute with terror, confessing to Wallace that she had become afraid of her own shadow, that if so much could be taken so quickly, then nothing was taken. Instead of becoming afraid, Wallace had become angry, angry that the killer was given a slap on the wrist and put back on the street, angry that those who killed with a bullet the size of a fingertip could be imprisoned for life, even executed, but those who killed with a bullet the size of a Buick were often dealt with as if they were the victims. Davis and Gail had worked hard to provide a sense of stability for the remnants of Wallace's family, but it was Davis who had helped the most. He made sure friends and relatives came around to lift the burden of the day-to-day when necessary. He took time away from his law practice to make sure things that needed to be done got done. And eventually, from somewhere deep inside, Carol found a way to cope. At first, she focused on putting one foot in front of the other, trying hard to impose some distance between herself and the devastating effect. Then one day, the dam broke, and she began a period of proper grieving. It had been painful to see, but Wallace took it as a sign that it was okay to begin the process of repairing and getting on with her own life. She considered herself still to be a work in progress, and she credited Davis and his wife with helping to make that progress possible. Sitting on the back steps of her Garden District bungalow, a half-finished cup of coffee on the concrete step next to her, Wallace watched a pair of squirrels chase each other around the trunk and through the branches of the giant pecan tree that dominated the back of the lot. She marveled at the speed and agility of the chittering creatures as they made gravity-defying leaps through the leafy canopy. As she reached for the book that lay next to her cup of coffee, her phone buzzed again. It was Chief of Detectives Jason Burley, her boss. She felt sure he wasn't calling to invite her to a birthday dinner. So now I'm skipping forward to the place where Wallace's interaction with the man who has been accused of the murder takes place. And we're looking at this through the eyes of the accused man himself. Chapter 6. The shame game was a delicate business. Come down too hard and you alienate the squeamish and miss a chance to pick up new followers. Too easy, and you risk losing some you already had. Through long practice, Eddie Pitkin had developed a workable balance. During some of his early attempts, mistakes were made. A few had been bad mistakes, but he was a diligent student. From every mistake, he learned a valuable lesson, and he allowed those lessons to shape his thoughts and his actions for future encounters. Goals were served before ego, principles trump emotions. Approach with a smile and an outstretched hand like you were greeting a long-lost friend. Craft your questions carefully and give your target the chance to say the right thing. Give them several chances. Never ridicule. Never raise your voice. If they became upset and pushed back, perfect. You never knew what would come out of someone's mouth when they felt off balance and self-righteous. People often reveal the truth of their hearts when they were feeling the right kind of stress. And always get it on video. Make sure the sound was crystal clear and don't be afraid to publish it. To Eddie, who had reached adulthood before the internet became so ubiquitous, YouTube was almost too good to be true. His was a slow, methodical process, but it worked. It was the same routine skilled courtroom attorneys used to get what they wanted from a hostile witness. Eddie had been such an attorney back in the day, but now, after having passed through a valley of deep shadow, he had emerged to serve a higher purpose. Today's target would be tough. Somehow the man had gotten wind that he was on Eddie's list, so he would be on guard, but he was a public figure of sorts, so it was impossible for him to hide and still do his job. He was also a kind man, and that caused Eddie discomfort. The mission was more important than the feelings or even the reputation of any one person, but Eddie was not oblivious to the sensibilities of his target. He just couldn't afford to cater to them. Eddie looked across the expanse of open lawn in front of the church and pulled his hat low on his forehead against the afternoon sun. It was one of those brilliant blue days in late spring when the air was that perfect temperature, when you couldn't feel it against your skin, and the humidity was low, a rarity for Baton Rouge, where for much of the warm season, the heat and the humidity were often in the high double digits. Afternoon mass had let out several minutes ago. A thinning tide of parishioners streamed around him heading for their cars. And about 40 yards away, his assistant, Marla Krismer, straddled her moss-green Vespa at the edge of the lawn. Marla was very nice looking. Her shoulder-length blonde hair and her faintly tanned Swedish skin were difficult to look away from, and she was unmistakably interested in Eddie. At 23, she was also young enough to be his daughter. In fact, she had been introduced by one of Eddie's daughters. But Eddie was not interested in Marla. He was married, unhappily at the moment, but married nevertheless, and while temptations came his way with enough frequency to keep his middle-aged self-image amusingly inflated, adultery was a territory into which he would not cross. He had crossed a lot of lines in his time, but infidelity would not be one. He recognized the opportunities, appreciated the flattery they represented, and he resolutely turned his mind against them. I'm old-fashioned, he thought. So sue me. He loved his wife and his children, and he supposed they loved him back, although he didn't always make himself easy to love, especially lately. Eddie looked over at Marla again. Her long, delicate fingers danced across the screen of her phone. Then he looked down and read her text on his own phone. He's left the rectory, approaching from your right. 30 seconds. As Eddie rose from the bench, he ran through his script. Stick to the script, he reminded himself, and then he muttered a quick prayer. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Marla dismount from her Vespa and move in his direction. Eddie turned to meet his target, a heavyset man with thinning hair and ruddy complexion. The clerical collar and his easygoing expression gave the man gravity. He was laughing at something one of his companions would say. Father Milton, I'm Eddie Pitkin. Eddie's hand went out. His smile slid into place. The laughter stopped and the mirth faded from the faces of the priest and the two men with him. One of the men tried to move between Eddie and Father Milton, but the priest held out his arm, blocking him. Marla was off to the side, her phone camera running. It's okay, the priest said as he stepped forward. Good to see you, Mr. Pitkin. The priest gripped the offered hand with his right and laid his left hand on top in a shepherd fashion. I suppose you've gone to the trouble of tracking me down to let me know that you and I are related, distant cousins, maybe? Eddie gave him a sheepish grin. No, Father, not me, but there are about 24 other black people scattered across this part of the state who are. And I think I'll just leave it there.
Good place.
And that was Roger Johns reading from River of Secrets, the second in the Wallace Hartman mystery series. So, Roger, I know you're working on number 3, but are there more planned after that?
I will write these books as long as my publisher is willing to publish them. I may write them even if they're not willing to publish them. I'm having such an interesting time writing this story. I think there's more yet for me to discover with this character, although River of Secrets roughs her up pretty seriously by the time the end of the book comes around. She will definitely be a changed woman in book three and beyond.
Very, very interesting. Very intriguing. What made you start writing police procedurals after a career in corporate law and as a professor?
Well, the writing bug, the writing impulse has been with me, I think, probably all of my life. It bit hard the first time several years ago, maybe in the late 80s, when I tried writing science fiction short stories and that didn't work out. And then I tried writing comedy for television. I even moved to Los Angeles to be close to the industry, and that didn't work out. And then I sort of forgot about things until late in my teaching career. I got this idea that eventually became the first book, Dark River Rising. And I went at it and never really got very far. I even took classes on how to write novels, but nothing seemed to work out. So I put it away and eventually got to retirement. And after about 3 weeks of indulging my lovely new life as a retired individual, I was bored out of my skull. And my lovely wife, she never said a word, but I could just see it in her face. This, don't you want to do something? Look, you don't have to do anything, but don't you want to do something? And of course, she was right. I did want to do something. So I dragged that manuscript out of the drawer and began to work on it. And after several failed attempts with the male character at the wheel, the idea to write it as a woman main character came to me. And once I got that first one finished, I thought, well, this is something I could do. It was hard work, but it was so interesting, so much more interesting than anything I had done before, that I decided to stick with it. And when I sold the book, that was all the encouragement.
And how did that happen?
I started going to the Atlanta Writers Conference, which is sponsored twice a year by the Atlanta Writers Club. And they bring in agents and editors from New York and California, from all the big houses. And you can pitch your book to them, or if you pay some money, you can have them read 20 pages or so a few months ahead of time. And when the conference rolls around, they'll critique your work. So I did that, and probably two or three times, and just failed miserably every time. And the fourth time, I sent my pages off to a woman named April Osborne at St. Martin's Press. She showed up, did a critique for me at the conference, and said she wanted to read the rest of the book. So I sent it to her. And a few months later, she called me back, and she said, I'd like to buy your book. So that's how it happened. And at that point, it was easy to get an agent because I already had a bite on the book, so to speak.
Right.
So I found an agent, a woman that I had spent some time with at another conference that I felt comfortable with, and she agreed to have me as a client.
Now, that's interesting because some people in that situation might think, well, I don't need an agent. I already have a publisher, and you're even an attorney, so you might be more inclined to think that. Why did you decide it was worth it to go ahead and pay an agent?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One, I'm always fearful of the unknown unknown. So that's the thing that's going to upset your apple cart in the most dramatic way. It always is. And I was also aware that even though I knew a lot about certain elements of the law, I didn't know anything about publishing contracts. So I was fearful of that is where the unknown unknown was lurking, that I would think, oh, that's fine, and it'd just be a bit of industry terminology that I didn't know. So I wasn't getting anywhere near the signature line on that until someone explained it to me. And it turned out it was a good move. There were almost no parts of the contract that would have been objectionable or dangerous down the road, but there were things that I needed to know before I made the decision to go forward. And I'm glad that I had someone in my corner. Plus, thinking down the road, when you're dealing with a publishing house, there are going to be creative decisions and they're going to be business concerns. And while it's always fine to argue a bit with your editor about creative matters, it's always a very bad idea to argue with your editor about business ideas or business concerns. So you want a surrogate, someone who is going to go into that conversation, and you don't have to be a part of it. You don't have to be the person that the editor is, you know, having to struggle with to get a point across or deal with in a tough negotiation. So I feel like it was a good short-term investment as well as a good long-term investment. And my agent proved to be very able very congenial and very responsive. I feel like I have her complete attention.
Well, that's excellent advice about why you need an agent. And presumably, since you've published your second book, the first book did well?
I think so. It's hard to know because the competition is so great. There are about 2.5 million books published a year. And yes, it's a staggering number. And I think a publisher's expectations for a given book in a given genre from a given author just depends on how they envision that writing career going from the beginning. This was my first published book, my first book I'd ever written, actually. So they didn't have any history about me to work with. And for someone like me, I'm guessing that expectations would be reasonable but modest, and that what they're looking for is more of a book-to-book improvement, an upward trajectory, than some formulaic number of units sold by a certain date. At least that's the way it's been explained to me. When I first signed with St. Martin's, which is the publisher of these books, my editor told me that it generally takes 3 to 5 books for an unknown mystery author to break out. You won't know very much before that, but by 3 to 5, you'll know if what they've got is something that the market is interested in. It just takes a while. And St. Martin's has been, pretty good about cultivating writers over the long term. And I see that in the daily interactions between me and my editor.
Now, we have a hard copy version of the book. Is it also coming out in paperback?
I guess so someday, but there are no plans to do it at the moment. So I'll have to say I don't know again.
Now, did you have to go on the promotional tour like some authors do? Did you do that with your first book?
I did. Between the day the first book came out and its anniversary, which was August 29th of this year, I made 56 personal appearances. I covered the country 3 times.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And it was a lot of work, an enormous amount of work, because I'm promoting one book, editing the second book, writing the third book. And it's a lot of driving, a lot of flying. And for somebody like me who had a bad case of what I call OMS, or old man syndrome, where for a few weeks I was content to sleep late, read the paper, take a nap, I found the book tour, while it was a lot of work, to be an enormous amount of fun. I have met so many interesting people and been to so many lovely bookstores and met some of the most wonderful booksellers and book buyers and readers you can possibly imagine. I took about a 6-week hiatus, more or less, as the first year was coming to a close. And it's gearing up now, again, for the Book 2 tour. And I really have to say, I got to missing all of that interaction. I got to miss all of the people and all of the places I've seen. But it's starting again, so my mood is on an upswing now.
So Book 2 came out approximately a year after Book 1 was published?
Almost a year to the day, 355 days to be exact.
So I'm guessing you were writing it during the time when Book 1 was getting ready to be published.
Yes.
And so this is sort of like you're on a cycle now. You got to keep pumping them out.
Yes, it's a three-piece world. You're promoting the books in existence. You're editing the next book, and you're writing the one or ones to come after that. And that's the cycle. And
in today's publishing world, if you get a contract with a major publisher like you did, do they fund the book tour? Do they cover your expenses?
That depends. Yes. For a first-time unknown author like me, the answer is no. They give some logistical support and occasionally some monetary support, and they have enormous reach. So if there are places I want to go and events that I want to do that I can't do myself, I know who to call, and they can make these things happen. But in terms of spending dollars on plane tickets and hotel rooms and the like, the answer to that is no. Though that might change if they paid an author a really substantial seven-figure advance. They would put a lot more muscle behind that, just for economic reasons. They would be remiss if they didn't. But for those of us who are on the lower end of that, the answer is no. It's on my dime. And I'm happy to do it because I want the books to be successful. And I know that St. Martin's wants the books to be successful. So I'm very content to earn my way higher up the food chain, so to speak. They've been lovely people to work with.
It seems like a lot of authors, even when they have a publishing contract, you know, as opposed to self-publishing or with an independent press, a lot of them still do hire their own publicists in addition to whatever assistance they get from the publisher's publicist or publicity department. Have you found that to be true also?
It's true in my case, for certain, and I know other authors who have done it. I thought about hiring a publicist for the first book, but I couldn't figure out how to do it right. It took me about 8 months of being on tour and meeting other authors and learning about their experiences with their publicists, their outside publicists, before I could figure out how to do it in a way where I felt like I was going to be getting value for my money. So I signed on with an outside publicist in May of this year, maybe it was late April. I'm very, very happy with what they are doing. My assumption going in was that they would promise the moon and some things would get done someday, but with the publishers that I'm with, it's turned out to be a very, very different proposition. I'm having to run furiously just to keep up with them. Everything they said they would do, they've done it, and it's either been on time or early. So I'm sleeping in my running shoes.
We love your publicists too. They send us a lot of great authors.
Yes, I'm absolutely thrilled with them. I couldn't have asked for a better relationship, both at a personal level and a professional level with this group. I think they hung the moon.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Roger Johns, author of River of Secrets. Roger, one thing I really want to get into is the theme, or a theme of this mystery, is racism, and in the Deep South. That's a fairly controversial issue right now.
It is.
Can you tell us why you decided to, and you dove in head first. I mean, we're talking reparations here. What's your, why did you want to go into such a controversial area?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad you've given me a chance to talk about that. Baton Rouge is a lovely town. It's a wonderful town. I lived there for 10 years. But like many towns, it has troubles. And this is an area that has troubled Baton Rouge for a long, long time. There was recently an outbreak of very serious racial difficulties in Baton Rouge, and there were outbreaks of it when I was living there. And those aspects of the city are always heartbreaking. And I think everyone there, every thinking person there is constantly hoping and praying someday we can learn to have a fully harmonious city. So I wanted to dig in deep on something like this to see what it would look like from the perspective of someone who was pursuing the sort of agenda that Eddie Pitkin, the man who was arrested for this murder, how he would see it. And I wanted to see how it would look like from a perspective of a police officer who was having to deal with this, because police officers dealing with racially sensitive situations is something that is in our consciousness on a more or less constant basis. And it just seemed like something that I needed to address, because it's something that is part of our lives. I could look at this and figure out how it might look and how there might be a glimmer of hope. And I think at the end of the book, although there are dark times in the book, I think by the time the reader gets to the end of the book, they will see that it's possible that there is a glimmer of hope, that these things will indeed find their way to some sort of resolution someday. But that being said, it was a scary experience for me, because I wanted to make sure I treated it with the respect that a sensitive subject like this absolutely deserves. So I was very, very careful, very, very thoughtful. And readers will let me know whether I've done this correctly or not. I hope that I have.
Are you at all concerned about pushback from, I mean, you are still in the Deep South, but pushback from people who might take a different perspective than you on who's the hero here?
Yeah, of course, I would be naive to say or to believe that there will be people who will read this book, or that everyone who reads this book will see the story the same way I do. I believe that I've taken the right approach to it. I have so far not been given any reason to believe that I got that part of it wrong. And there's been no explicit pushback from any of the people that have read and reviewed the book. And there's been a pretty fair amount of online reviews, you know, reader reviews and professional reviews. So as the days march on, I'm feeling a little bit more confident about it. But yes, I did think those thoughts, clearly.
Well, sometimes fiction can be a great way to, to change people's minds when they see something in the context of a story, that it can give, or at least to open people's minds to the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that we can imagine things as we would hope they would turn out. We can imagine things that are slight variations of the way they really are. And if it's done with earnestness and one's heart in the right place, and I believe that both of those would apply to me and my effort in River of Secret, that we can bring about a level of understanding, and we can do it in a way that people can read the book and maybe reread certain parts of it and imagine these things on their own. It's a spark for a conversation, a spark for a change in thought. This book, more than the first one, is close to my heart, because the first book involves things that could happen to anyone, anywhere, and the second book could only happen in the Deep South, and it could only happen the way it did to Wallace. I can't say more on that because it would spoil the story. So this book was much closer to me on an emotional level than the first one. So I worked really hard to try and get things right and to give people any way to think about and imagine race relations in the South, in the modern South, when things can get heated up very quickly.
Roger, earlier in our interview, you mentioned that you know where the story, you know how the story is going to end when you start. How much of the twists and turns of the plot, which, you know, in a police procedural, you definitely have to have a variety of suspects, and there have to be ways that it looks like it might be one person and it ends up being another person. How much of that have you plotted out before you start writing, and how much grows organically during the writing process?
I always know the beginning, and I always know the end point, but for both of these books, it turns out I didn't have a very clear picture of which of the infinite number of routes between the start and the finish I would ultimately take. So there was a lot of discovery, a lot of trial and error. Whole storylines came and went, characters came and went. In the first book, characters that I had originally killed, my editor insisted that they come back to life. And so they did. So I'm good with the beginning and the end. It turns out I'm not so clear-headed when it comes to the middle. But you're right. When you write a mystery, it has to work like a clock. Everything that needs to be there has to be there. And you don't want to make the reader mad by cheating away some of the necessary parts. But there's a lot. I find that to be a lot of fun. There are people I know that plot it out in great detail. But for me, I don't know that I would even want to do that. It gets to be too much like typing at that point.
Do you take notes on characters or on ideas or things that, I want to put this in later? Or do you have any, or do you just sit down and write?
Oh, I'm constantly taking notes, constantly looking at the people around me and listening to them. When I was a little boy, living in Alexandria, my dad owned a store, and the alleyway that ran behind that store was the hard dividing line between the white part of town and the black part of town. And beyond that alley was a neighborhood and a house. In the house lived a black family with two children who were my age. And they were who I played with as a little boy. When I would go visit my dad at the store after school, that's where I would go and play in their yard behind the store. And one of the children, the girl child, called me Roger, but her brother called me Little White Boy. And that never left me. And that comes into this story in both books, because Wallace has a lifelong friend, and they met under similar circumstances, and that was the name that he used for her. So I've been literally carrying that around with me for 50-some-odd years. And there are other little bits of trivia from my own life. Not that that's trivial. I thought it was an amazing thing. It obviously stuck with me my entire life. But I keep other small parts of my life sort of in a catalog, and from time to time they will crop up in these books. And I'm also paying very close attention to the people around me for turns of phrase, a certain look, a certain attitude. It's great fun.
How many drafts of a book do you write, and do you tend to write from beginning to end and then go back and revise the whole thing, or do you revise as you go?
I tend to be a revise-as-I-go kind of a guy. My first attempt at getting something on the page is always just an approximation. So when I finish, whatever it is I finished the night before, the next day when I start, I back up about 3 or 4 paragraphs and start rewriting it just to make sure that those words are congruent with the thoughts that I had in my head when I was trying to get that point across. And then I just keep on going from there, and I repeat it the next day. And I wrote several drafts, maybe 7 or 8 of the first book. I didn't have that luxury by the time the second book came around, but I knew more about the character and the place, so I didn't really need to go through that many drafts with the second one. I think I did it in 2 drafts as opposed to 7 or 8.
Wow, that's pretty fast. What's your, do you have a certain schedule? Do you sit down and write at certain times of day, or where you block out whole days of writing and days of doing other things?
A little bit of both. I spend some part of every day just doing the book business, setting up promo things, working with my editor, working with my outside publicist, dealing with conferences and things that I'm doing for that. And the rest of the day I spend either cooking or cleaning or writing. And the period that I block out for writing tends to migrate. Sometimes it's early in the morning when I first get up. Other times it's late at night. I try not to limit myself because I don't want to feel like I'm becoming, stuck in a pattern, stuck in a rhythm. I'm afraid it might make things, the creative part of it go away. So I try and stay unfettered from too much routine. As long as I get the things done each day that I need to get done, I feel okay.
And you write on computer?
I do. In fact, I do almost all of it on computer. I do keep a little booklet with me when I'm away from the keyboard, and I write things down, the germ of an idea or a name or some fragment of something, but it's almost entirely composed at the keyboard.
Well, Roger, we are just about out of time, and I want to thank you for your patience with our technical difficulties earlier. And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yes, I do. As we have seen over and over through history, a lie is as powerful as the truth if you can get someone to believe it.
Wow. And do you have any closing words of advice for a would-be author?
Okay. Yes, don't ever give up. You will find that editor. You will write a good book, and you will experience the luck you need to connect with the editor that is the right person to bring your book into the world. And as a closing thought, I'd like to say to both of you, Monica and Caroline, thank you, a million thank yous for having me on your radio show. This has been so much fun.
Well, it was our pleasure, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.